Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Xfinity Mobile, featuring customized wireless plans. Customers can choose unlimited, buy the gig, shared data, or a mix of both and switch it up anytime. Learn more at xfinitymobile.com.
I'm Dave Iverson, and this is KQED News special coverage of the Proposition 8 ruling.
That's awful!
That's great. I'm so excited. Everyone deserves a chance and an opportunity. You know, straight people were born with the right to get married. So we should have the same equal rights as straight people.
Wow. Well, for once, justice opens her eyes.
It's a pretty good step in the right direction for our country. I think it's a small step, but it fills me with a lot of hope.
Very disappointed with the ruling and that a judge would overrule 7 million voters. I mean, this is a trend that's very disturbing.
Oh my God!
My husband and I were first married in 2004 during the Winter of Love. And then we were married again in 2008, and we've endured the ups and downs of the whole struggle. And I'm very, very excited that the ruling is in our favor this time.
That's how Kwa Nguyen, Robert Couric, Jeff Mead, Bill May, and Kenny Vick reacted in San Francisco today to the ruling by Federal District Judge Vaughn Walker that Proposition 8 was unconstitutional. Proposition 8, of course, was passed by voters back in November of 2008, and it declared that only a marriage between a man and a woman was recognized in California. In a point-by-point 136-page ruling, Judge Walker outlined all the reasons why he felt Proposition 8 violated both the Due Process and Equal Protection Clauses of the United States Constitution. In the end, concluding that, quote, "It fails to advance any rational basis in singling out gay men and lesbians for denial of a marriage license," unquote. In issuing today's order, Judge Walker also put his ruling on hold until both sides can present arguments on whether the ruling should be stayed pending an appeal. That means his ruling will not immediately go into effect. For the next half hour, we'll hear from both the winning and losing sides of this landmark case today, and we'll also get analysis from two constitutional scholars. Joining us for KQED News, Mina Kim, who was at the Victoria Side press conference today. Mina?
Hi, Dave. Nice to see you. Yes, I was at the press conference today, and a couple of things struck me about it. One was initially that the mood was fairly subdued. I think people had a real sense that this is a great step, but as one step in a long legal battle. But at the same time, it was very triumphant, and lead attorney Ted Olson sort of summarized the ruling this way.
This is a victory for the American people. It's a victory for our justice system. When our individual rights are taken away, when the majority decides that an unpopular group of individuals should be treated differently, and they can't succeed at the ballot box because they are unpopular, because they are a minority, because they are viewed differently by a number of people in the populace, they turn to the courts of the United States, and we have a spectacular constitution that values equality and values fundamental rights and values an independent judiciary to protect and vindicate those rights.
The words of Ted Olson, the lead attorney on the winning side of today's ruling by Judge Vaughn Walker. Ted Olson, of course, also a former solicitor general. This ruling was widely expected today, I think it's fair to say. Mina Kim, was there a sense of validation, victory, jubilation? How would you characterize the sort of overall sense at the press conference today?
Well, lead attorney, in addition to lead attorney Ted Olson, his other lead attorney, David Boies, was there, and he seemed to take great joy in talking about how the judge eviscerated the argument of the defendants or the attorneys who were for the ban on gay marriage, and even pointed out how the judge was saying the witnesses seemed to support the plaintiff's side significantly. The other people that were there were the four plaintiffs, the gay male couple and the lesbian couple. They were flanked. They were against a backdrop of eight American flags. I'm not sure if that was deliberate or not. But Kristen Perry, who is often the named plaintiff in the case, Perry versus Schwarzenegger is the name of the case, put what the decision meant to her in this way.
"For so long, Sandy and I and our family have been regarded as less than,
unequal, not worthy of liberty and the pursuit of happiness under the law. But this decision says that we are Americans too.
Kristen Perry speaking at today's press conference. David Boies, the other lead attorney, was also there, the one who felt, as you said, especially triumphant. Characterize his views and what he had to say today.
Well, he was certainly very confident. Though mentioning that this will likely go to the Supreme Court, he was very confident that they would win in the Supreme Court, and he gave several reasons for that.
One of the things that the judge, Walker, makes clear in his opinion is this does not ask the courts to establish a new right. The fundamental right to marry is already established by ample Supreme Court precedent. And this case does not ask the courts to establish a new right for gay and lesbians not to be discriminated against. That right has already been established in United States Supreme Court precedents over the last 10 years. All this case asks is that the court...
David Boies went on to say there that it's just simply saying that marriage is a fundamental right, that depriving gay and lesbian couples of the right to marry actually harms their children and themselves, and also that the state has no benefit from depriving same-sex couples the right to marry. Both attorneys summarized the decision, basically really praising the judge, saying that his ruling, his lengthy ruling, as you mentioned, Dave, was thoughtful, careful, and analytical, and that it showed that the facts are out there, and they can't imagine an argument against those facts coming up that will overturn what Walker has said today.
Well, we'll turn now to what some of those potential arguments might be. Mina Kim, KQED News, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Dave.
Joining us now is Daniel Blumberg. He's an attorney with the Alliance Defense Fund and was part of the legal team arguing in support of Proposition 8. Mr. Blumberg, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
As you just heard from Mina Kim's report, the people who were on the winning side today took some pleasure in the ruling that Judge Walker issued today, not only because of the outcome, but I think in part because the way in which he characterized the ruling again and again, if you go through the ruling, he indicates the way in which he felt your side of the argument just didn't quite hold up, that there wasn't a credible evidence that you put forward, that people were not believable on your side of this argument. How do you respond to the fact that the judge, in such a point-by-point way, seemed to say that your side just did not make its case?
You know, what we think is that one judge in San Francisco ignored the law and put himself above the 7 million people in California who voted on this. Now, basically, his ruling here is that those 7 million people and the millions of Americans like them, the majority of Americans like them across the country, who made their votes, who cast their votes to protect the definition of marriage, were irrational when they did that. Now, maybe that's true of his neighbors. It's not true of ours. Now, this case has just begun. This is the very start, very beginning of the case. And the Alliance Defense Fund and the rest of the ProtectMarriage.com legal team, we're planning on staying in this all the way through to win it.
On the particular point about your view that what's important here is to listen to the will of the people, and you cited the number of Californians who voted in support of Proposition A in November 8 and November of 2008, the judge said, quote, that the majority of California voters supported Proposition 8 is irrelevant because, he went on to say, fundamental rights, and you heard David Boies make the argument that this is not a new right, it's a fundamental right. Fundamental rights are not subject to elections. How do you respond to his logic on that?
Well, of course, that's not true. I mean, all the rights that we enjoy are ones that have been put in place by the majority vote in the first place. That's how a democracy works. And that's the issue here. In America, we should respect and uphold the right of free people to make policy choices through the democratic process, especially ones that do nothing more than uphold the definition of a marriage that's existed since before the Constitution itself was established. And this isn't an issue of denying fundamental rights. It's about protecting the institution of marriage from a radical redefinition.
Judge Walker argued that this was not a new right. David Boies, you heard commenting on that fact, and that there was no compelling reason not to give same-sex couples that ability to marry. He says at one point, quote, same-sex couples are just as able as opposite-sex couples in the characteristics relevant to the ability to form successful marital unions. So he's making the argument that there is no difference.
And that's simply not true. I mean, people know intuitively that there's a difference between a man and a woman, and what's unreasonable, and in fact what's radical, is to allow a handful of activists to gut the core of the American democratic system and force, essentially, potentially, at the end of this case, the entire country to accept a system that intentionally denies children the mom and dad they deserve.
Well, on that point, he also says that he found your arguments not, again, quote, not supported by the evidence, that there was no evidence put forward in the trial and the ruling of Judge Walker that indicates that kids are any better off in a male-female parenting situation than they are when the parents are non-biological.
Well, see, but that's exactly one of the issues. To make that ruling, he has to find that it was absolutely irrational. There's no possible rational basis for someone to come to that conclusion. Of course, that's completely unreasonable to say that the entirety of human civilization has recognized the fundamental role of a mother and a father in the formation of a family has always been irrational and unreasonable. That's just not accurate. It's just not true.
As I understand what he was ruling, it wasn't to say that was not a useful model. He seemed to be making the argument that there are other models and that there's no evidence, that you did not put forward any evidence to suggest that children would be better off, that a same-sex couple is any less likely to form a successful union than an opposite-sex sex couple, that you just didn't make the case.
Well, but see, that's not the legal standard. The legal standard here is he has to show that the will of the people of California, the 7 million voters, were absolutely irrational in deciding what they did. There's no possible reasonable basis for them or any of the other Americans who have made this same vote. And that's what he decided. That's what he held. And it's a really pretty shocking holding.
Daniel Blomberg joining us again. He's an attorney with the Alliance Defense Fund and was part of the legal team arguing in support of California's Proposition 8. Mr. Blomberg, tell us something about what's next. There's going to be the judge has stayed his order, at least temporarily. There'll be a hearing now on whether or not that stay will continue while the appeal process goes forward. Tell us what your team is going to do next.
Well, the next step, and in fact the step we were taking even before the holding came out, was to ensure that there would be a stay, that we could allow this entire case to be litigated completely. We knew from day one when the case was filed that this was the type of case that was going to need more than just a district court's holding. And so we'll probably be going before the Ninth Circuit and potentially even before the U.S. Supreme Court to protect the right of voters to make these kind of decisions in a democracy.
And outline for us why you think it's important that Judge Walker's ruling be stayed while that appeals process goes forward.
Well, I think one of the basic reasons is that we have a lot of people who are going to be trying to make decisions one way or the other, and you don't want to make a decision on a shaky foundation. So this is a good time to allow the court to allow this case to be litigated completely.
Daniel Blomberg, again, he is with the Alliance Defense Fund, part of the legal team arguing in support of Proposition 8. Mr. Blomberg, thanks very much for adding your views to our program today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
I want to get analysis now of the ruling and really dig into what the ruling had to say and the various arguments that Judge Walker put forward. And joining us now for this part of our program, Vikram Amar. He's professor of law and associate dean for academic affairs at the University of California Davis School of Law. Vikram Amar, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Dave.
And Eugene Volokh joins us as well. He's professor of law at the UCLA School of Law. Professor Volokh, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's just start with your general reaction. You've heard a little bit of what both of the parties have said so far about the nature of the ruling. As you look through it first, Vikram Amar, what stood out to you about the way in which Judge Walker came to his decision?
I guess I'd say two things. First, the ruling was very broad in that, unlike earlier aspects of the trial, where Judge Walker seemed to indicate that there were particular problems with California's ban on same-sex marriage, This opinion was written so as to, if it were adopted by the Ninth Circuit, call into question the bans on same-sex marriages in virtually all states. So this was not a California-specific reasoning that Judge Walker employed. So it'll be interesting to see not only whether the Ninth Circuit agrees with his result, but also agrees with his ruling, with his reasoning.
Does that mean, Vic, that this potentially has impact well beyond the borders of the state?
Not technically, because a district court judge's ruling doesn't extend beyond his own court. So the ruling has rhetorical and analytic implications beyond the Northern District of California. But that was true even before the ruling came down, because those same arguments, those broad arguments, had been out there in the ether. But if the Ninth Circuit were to adopt not just the result but the reasoning of Judge Walker's ruling, then that would apply in all the western states and call into question bans on same-sex marriage, not just in California, but across the West. I think important aspect of the opinion is, as dramatic as this ruling was today, I don't think it really changes the world that much in the following sense. Everything really comes down to what the Ninth Circuit says, and if they act in a certain way, then what the Supreme Court says, although I think the Supreme Court will weigh in only if the Ninth Circuit invalidates Prop 8. If the Ninth Circuit reverses Judge Walker, I'm not sure the U.S. Supreme Court will be in any hurry to get into this thicket. But there isn't that much, I think, in Judge Walker's opinion that's going to constrain Ninth Circuit judges who disagree with him from reversing him. It's true that the opinion makes a lot of credibility determinations and findings of fact, but I think most of the key analytic moves that Judge Walker makes in reaching his outcome, namely the meaning of rationality review, that's what you were just talking to Mr. Bloomberg about. What does it mean to say a law is irrational? And whether gays and lesbians should be specially protected by the courts? And whether plaintiffs are seeking simply to invoke the historic right to marriage, or are they trying to expand it? On all those key questions, the Ninth Circuit, I think, is going to feel pretty free to revisit those issues on its own and not have to pay a lot of deference to what Judge Walker said or did. Now, maybe that the Ninth Circuit or the three judges who are drawn agree with Judge Walker, but I think technically they're going to have a lot of independence to decide this case on their own, and so that's really where the action is at.
Vic Amar at the University of California School of Davis, joining us along with Eugene Volokh, professor of law at the UCLA School of Law. Professor Volokh, do you concur that the way in which Judge Walker framed this argument gives the three-judge panel, there are, 30-some judges, I guess, that are part of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, but there will be three who rule on this, that they have ample room to go in whichever way they want?
Yeah, I agree with pretty much everything that Vic Amar has said. I think his analysis is exactly correct.
Fine. And that's true, I think, generally in life.
Well, I follow Vic in all things. But in this thing in particular, I think his analysis is exactly right.
Well, tell me more about why that would be so. Because as a layman, as I read through the ruling this afternoon, what seems to jump out is how strongly Judge Walker views this case. As Mina Kim said earlier, he really seems to eviscerate the other side's argument and seems rather annoyed that they didn't put forward a better case. Again and again, he says they eschewed all but limited presentations. They provided no credible evidence. It was not supported by the evidence, so forth and so on. But Gene Volokh, does that, even though he put it forward in such a strong way, that doesn't necessarily mean that the decision will be either easier or harder to reverse by the Ninth Circuit?
I think as a practical matter, I think that's right. So his legal conclusions are reviewed from scratch by the Ninth Circuit. They're not supposed to defer at all to his conclusions on questions of law. Now, factual matters, it is often said, are reviewed differentially by the, that is to say, with deference by the Court of Appeals, so that if the trial judge finds facts, then the Court of Appeals will accept them unless they seem clearly erroneous. But that tends to involve cases where these are historical facts about what happened in this particular case. When we're talking about essentially inferences that he drew from the social science evidence that was presented to him, that's the kind of fact sometimes called a legislative fact by lawyers. It's the kind of fact having to do with the making of law, whether by Congress or by judges, that I think appellate judges are not going to defer much to him on. Another way of putting it is, look, there's this hot controversy about whether in fact children raised in same-sex households, raised by same-sex couples are somehow worse off than children raised by opposite-sex couples. The judge reports that based on his view of the evidence, the community of psychiatrists and of scholars who study this say, well, there is no visible difference. So if that were all that was at issue, then I suppose the court might defer to his factual conclusions. But in fact, the real question here is, to what extent can the voters say, look, we've only had a few decades of considering this matter. It's very hard to do really thorough social science on the subject, among other things, because it's not like you can randomly assign children to same-sex couples versus opposite-sex couples. So as a result, we don't really know what the answer is. The psychiatrists might tell us something, but they may have their own biases, and in any event, they don't have that much data. It should be up to us as the voters, or in other states, as voters, up to our, the legislators representing the voters, to decide, look, now is not the time to make this kind of change in the absence of more evidence. That's the kind of question that I think is going to be before the Court of Appeals. And on that, the particular factual findings made by the district court, I think, are not going to be tremendously persuasive.
So if I've got this right, Vikamar, the arguments that Judge Walker put forward in his ruling, that there's no evidence to suggest that same-sex couples can't form just as good a union as heterosexual couples, that kids are fine, that the state has no interest in setting up any kind of differentiation, that domestic partnerships aren't as good, that's all really not what's at stake at the appeal level. What's at stake at the appeal level is more this question of whether or not the voters will be what trumps everything else?
Well, not quite. I think Eugene actually put his finger right on the key question. I think the soft underbelly of Judge Walker's ruling was his rather cursory dismissal of the argument that incrementalism and cautiousness in proceeding with social change can itself be a rational public policy stance to take.
Mm-hmm.
So remember, to be irrational, every single reason that the voters might have had on their minds has to be irrational. If anything the voters had on their minds in support of Prop 8 is rational, then Prop 8 is rational. So it's the challengers of Prop 8 who have to win on every conceivable reason that someone might have thought Prop 8 is a decent idea, and I personally didn't. But the idea that, as Eugene put it, that maybe it's sensible to take a breath and see how civil unions have worked out for a while before we take the next step, whether that is inherently irrational or not is not so much a factual question but a legal one that the Ninth Circuit is going to look at on its own.
So we're going to get some updates from what's going on out in the city in just a moment. But just a quick thought, one more on that, please, Vikamar. So the key question here then really in the end is that in order for Prop 8 to be tossed, it has to be found irrational on every level?
Under Judge Walker's rationale, yes. But remember, the plaintiffs who challenged Prop 8 argued as well not only that Proposition 8 is irrational, but that a higher standard ought to apply, that we should insist on what we call heightened or strict scrutiny. And Judge Walker did find that such heightened scrutiny should apply, but he said it doesn't matter because this Prop 8 fails even the lowest level of judicial inquiry. If the Ninth Circuit were to agree with Judge Walker and the plaintiffs that a higher standard applies, then I think it's hard to justify Prop 8. But if the battle remains one fought over the meaning of rationality, then I think there's a decent chance that three judges of the Ninth Circuit would disagree with Judge Walker.
Vikram Amar and Eugene Volokh joining us to provide their analysis of Judge Walker's decision. If you would both please stay with us. We'll come back to you for a comment at the end of our program. But right now we want to hear also from Rachel Dornhelm, who has been gathering reaction to today's decision in San Francisco's Castro neighborhood. Rachel, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hi.
Give us some sense of what you're finding out in the streets of San Francisco this afternoon.
Well, things are really upbeat. I'm at the corner of Market and Castro, and the crowd has just been swelling in the past 15 minutes. There are people with flags, American flags and rainbow flags, and a lot of signs that say liberty and justice for all. Cars are honking, people are cheering, and people say this is where they felt they had to come. There are a lot of people who said they came here when Prop 8 passed, and they just felt compelled to come back today.
And what's going to be going on for the rest of the evening? There's supposed to be a march, as I understand it. Tell us what's going to be going on, what kind of speakers the crowd may hear from.
Sure. At 5 p.m. is when the rally officially starts here. And from 5 to 6, people will be here. They'll hear from some local politicians. There'll also be some members of the clergy who are here, leaders of different religious groups. And then at 6 p.m., the crowd will start marching down Market Street towards City Hall. There'll be some members of the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus will lead sing-alongs, and there'll be some bands along the way.
And any sense yet of the size of the crowd, Rachel?
Trying to estimate it. Like I said, it just keeps growing. But it seems to me maybe there are 100, 200 at this point.
All right. Rachel Dornhelm in the Castro neighborhood getting ready to cover the march that will now be taking place from the Castro down to City Hall. Rachel, thanks for giving us that update.
Thank you.
And rejoining us, Eugene Volokh, professor of law at the UCLA School of Law, and Vikram Omar from the University of California Davis School of Law. Eugene Volokh, it sounds like people, at least in the Castro neighborhood of San Francisco, understandably excited. Would you tell them to sort of put their excitement on hold?
Well, I can't see why they shouldn't be excited. This is a sign that that a judge, and in fact, as it happens, a appointee of President Bush Sr., so a Republican appointee, agreed with an argument that they care deeply about. At the same time, and I'm sure they recognize that these battles are almost never won at the federal district court level. There's going to be an appeal to the Court of Appeals, then, if the Court of Appeals agrees with Judge Walker, it seems almost certain that the U.S. I shouldn't say almost certain, always dangerous to say that at this, but I think it's very likely the U.S. Supreme Court will decide to hear the case, because I think they'll conclude that something as momentous as telling the citizens of many states that their opposite sex marriage only rules are unconstitutional should be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. At that point, I think chances are that at least the U.S. Supreme Court, as currently constituted, would probably disagree with Judge Walker. But it's not guaranteed. And who knows, if it comes up late enough, gets to the U.S. Supreme Court late enough that President Obama may have had another appointment to the court. Well, then in that case, it might come out the other way. Even though, interestingly, President Obama himself, at least based on his past statements, would disagree with this decision.
And Vikram Omar, give us a preview, if you would, of what's going to happen next in terms of the appeals case. What do you expect the people who support Proposition 8, the supporters of Proposition 8, to argue next, and what will be the comeback from those who want to see Proposition 8 overturned?
Well, first I'll go back to the question of the stay that you raised at the outset. I think it's likely that a stay will issue, because if a stay doesn't issue and people get married and the Ninth Circuit does reverse Judge Walker, we'll be in the same situation we were in 2004 with the Gavin Newsom authorized marriages, that they'll essentially have to be annulled. Because remember, if the Ninth Circuit reverses Judge Walker, it means that Proposition 8 was valid all along and the marriages never should have been entered into. So my expectation is there will be a stay over the next number of months while the Ninth Circuit wades in. I think what you're going to see at the Ninth Circuit is a replay of what happened in front of the district court, but in front of three judges, not one judge. And then if, as Eugene pointed out, if the Ninth Circuit affirms Judge Walker, then I could see it going to the Supreme Court. But if the Ninth Circuit reverses Judge Walker, I think that's the end of the case. I think neither the liberals nor the conservatives on the Supreme Court want to take this case unless they have to.
We just have about 20 or 30 seconds left, Gene Volokh. But will it be incumbent on the pro-proposition side, 8 side, to put forward a stronger case? Again, perhaps I'm reading too much into this, but Judge Walker seemed very dismissive of the case they put forward. Will that matter?
Well, surely they have to put on the strongest case that they can, but how strong a case is not just a function of what the people put on, but also of the judge who's perceiving it. I think they're hoping that the judges on the Ninth Circuit and eventually the U.S. Supreme Court will see their case as a strong one.
Eugene Volokh, professor of law at the UCLA School of Law. Gene Volokh, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks very much,
Brad. And Vic Amar joined us as well. He's professor of law at the University of California Davis School of Law. Vic Amar, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Dave.
KQED News will have continuing coverage on the Proposition 8 ruling tomorrow on the California Report, starting at 5:50 in the morning, and then again on Forum with Michael Krasny tomorrow at 9. I'm Dave Iverson. More news online at kqednews.org.